8:30, and we have with us, alive and kicking in our studios once again, Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Why, good morning to you.
Sorry we had to put those restraints on your legs, but you were actually kicking.
Could you loosen them a little bit? I'm starting to lose a little bit of circulation on my left foot.
If we just do this, if you do this smoothly, then you'll get them loosened in 29 minutes.
I seem to remember this. This is sort of similar to a scene I saw once from this. What was it? Misery. It was one of these Stephen King movies. That anyway. Morning.
Yeah, that brings back bad memories. So let's get going because we got a lot to cover.
Yes. Speaking of horror stories.
Yeah. Just open your King County voters pamphlet.
Yeah. There you go.
And you'll be right
there
with
us. A lot of scary grade B movie type faces staring at you from the pages. and most of them have the little star saying incumbent next to them.
Yeah. We're continuing our election coverage started last week. So
yes, continuous eyewitness election coverage. Although actually in this case it's before the primary and well, you hopefully haven't sent in your absentees yet, so you know a little bit more about the people that you're going to refuse to vote for this time, and in some cases vote for, because there are some good candidates out there.
Mm-hmm. So last week we covered city council and county council positions. That leaves us with what? Port of Seattle positions?
It leaves us with Port of Seattle, the Monorail Board, which is a brand new board, the school board district, and a couple of ballot initiatives.
Very good. So, and what category would you like to tackle first?
Maria, you're one of the other contestants here. By the way, what do you do for a living, Maria?
What do I do for a living? I'm an office manager.
Here on, that's great. Let's get a big hand for the office manager. Okay,
anyway,
now on your it's your life, it's your tax dollars, it's your election candidates.
Yes,
which candidate would you like first?
And I do pay taxes. Let's talk about the Port of Seattle, which raised taxes this past year by an incredible amount.
Yes, they did, and those taxes are going mostly into basically into the pockets of cruise ship companies and big container freight mobility
and
companies.
Initiatives to privatize port public assets.
Yeah, it really is one of the most corrupt public agencies, not just in Seattle or King County, but the West Coast of the country. Even by the standard of West Coast ports, Seattle is particularly venal. The public management of the port has been an ongoing scandal for many years, if not decades, and you know, you can throw in the third runway and the management of SeaTac as well as the actual harbor. And unfortunately, there are two candidates out of the five on the board who are up this year. In both cases, Bob Edwards and Claire Norquist, the incumbents, are running. It's very difficult for progressive candidates to run for the Port of Seattle because it is a county-wide vote. Most people don't pay attention to it. It's not on the evening TV news, and it has very low name recognition, so the incumbents usually walk. And in one case, Bob Edwards is the position number two candidate, and he basically has two non-entities who nobody's even heard from who are running against him, so I would skip that. But there is a very good candidate running in position number five, and in fact he was on this program a half hour ago, the 7:30 slot. Chris Kane has a very good background with the Port Observer, did a lot of trade activism around the WTO being in town, a real good guy. So Christopher Kane, position number five, he's running against Claire Norquist, who is actually even one of the more corrupt of the corrupt people on the Port of Seattle board.
Actually,
he's very good.
For position number two, I would probably go with Jim Baker, who's a personal injury attorney, over Bob Edwards.
Mm-hmm.
Baker is against the third runway at SeaTac, and probably for a very good reason. The third runway has been a problem. It's had in environmental problems, had trouble getting the permits for it. The people who live in the neighborhood don't want it. And there's a question now with the recession as to whether it's even necessary to build the third runway.
Yeah.
He's also against the privatization of public infrastructure at the port, which is a major issue that that both workers and residents in the city of Seattle who pay taxes to the port should be concerned about. And he's also against allowing private yachts into Fisherman's Terminal, which he says, and I believe is true, should remain a working Fisherman's Terminal.
Yeah, those are all good things. So Jim Baker.
Jim Baker for position two.
Okay. So shall we move on then to To the school board.
The school board.
I'm actually pretty excited about this year. There are good candidates running in every one of the four races for which they are up. Three of them running against incumbents, and because of the fiscal disaster that the school district has encountered in the past year, finally there is some public attention being paid to the school board having essentially given a free pass to the mismanagement and arrogance of the school district that we talk about pretty regularly on this show. I'll just run through them very briefly. The setup with the school board elections is that they are by district for the primary in September, and then the two lead candidates run citywide for November. So you'll only have one of these, depending on where in the city you live, or if you're not in the city, you won't see any of these folks. District number one, which is North Seattle, Sally Soriano is probably the best of the four. She's a very good person, ran for school board a couple of years ago, is really the heroine who, as much as any single person, was responsible for raising the public awareness of WTO before those protests in 99. She was working on anti-free trade stuff for literally a decade before that, often as the only person doing it. Worked on the old KCMU news team back when that existed at what this station was 10 years ago. So she's very good in district number one. District number two, Darlene Flynn, who was on this program at 7:30 a couple of weeks ago. She's very, very good. Number three, Brita Butler-Wall, who I can't say too much about because she's a good personal friend, and I dumped a buttload of money into her campaign, which I've never done before for anybody.
Thanks for this, the disclosure, Jav. Now,
yeah,
I haven't dumped any money into Brita's campaign, and I don't know her as well as Jav does, but she is an outstanding candidate.
Yeah, she really is. She pretty much single-handedly made commercialism in the schools district in Seattle not only a public issue, but reversed the city's policy on it, which is a pretty remarkable accomplishment. I mean, not single-handedly, but the group that she has chaired for the last 5 or 6 years, Citizens Campaign for Commercial Free Schools, has been very, very effective, and she's a big part of the reason. But she has a pretty good history of being involved in a number of different school issues. Also has been a state co-chair of the Greens, just a very good candidate, very well organized, sort of the prototypical soccer mom who got politicized a few years ago when she went to the school board and realized that, that they didn't really care what she thought because they wanted to run things for themselves. Thank you very much. So she's in position number three, and then position number four in West Seattle, Irene Stewart is the best of the bunch. And she, again, is a very good reform candidate. And all four of those candidates, Sally Soriano, Darlene Flynn, Brita Butler-Wall, and Irene Stewart, are fairly strong candidates who've gotten good money into their campaigns, gotten a number of key endorsements, and have pretty good chances of winning. Brita is running against Nancy Waldman, who is the president of the school board and has been for the last couple of years. And she's getting newspaper endorsements. I mean, you know, not just the Seattle Weekly and the Stranger, but you know, and a number of key unions and a lot of the educator groups, and the same is true for these other candidates as well. So, very, very exciting race. Good to pay attention to.
Okay. Moving on, the Monorail Authority.
Yeah, and I almost feel like you should talk about this, Maria, since you were you were writing about the monorail in the shorts the last issue. There are only two elected positions on the newly created monorail board,
which is a crime in itself.
Yeah, it really is. It's an outrage, particularly when you see cronies like Joel Horn being set up to run the monorail project, and we're starting to see already what kind of cronyism and fiscal mismanagement, exact same type of syndrome that sunk the Sound Transit is starting to infect the people's transit system.
Yeah, the big problem that the monorail is going through right now is accountability and openness. Members of the current board were upset to find out that there were problems in collecting revenue for the monorail, that the monorail has only collected about half the revenue that was projected for it in the first few months of this year. And they only found out after reading newspaper reports. They did not find out from Joel Horn, who should have been keeping them informed. So that's a major issue. And I think if we had more elected members of the board, then we'd have a more activist board, and we wouldn't be running up against these problems as much. There are two positions open. Position 8, Cindy Laws is the candidate for that position. People should vote for her. In position 9, there are two good candidates. Brett McMillan is the one that I would recommend. He's already been prying open the monorail process to public scrutiny, so he's definitely the person you want to go for this position. If you don't like Brett McMillan, Cleve Stockmeyer is another possibility, but I would urge people to vote for Brett.
Yeah, I'd say they're both very good, but I would go with Brett also. Brett has a couple of really, he's been the one public person who's been attending these meetings, watchdogging the board, and he was the person who pretty much single-handedly created the process of having limits on campaign donations for these elections for the monorail board because they forgot to write that into the law. He's had several victories around making the meetings more open and records available to the public and things
and
like
that's
that.
That's the direction
very,
we want to go.
Very good.
With the monorail.
And he's been very good on fiscal accountability. So
I think
Brett McMillan.
I think it's Brent, right?
Brent, I'm sorry.
Right.
Yeah.
Brett
sorry.
Is his evil twin. Okay.
And then we have two ballot ignition initiatives to round things off. We have I-75, which is essentially the pot initiative, which would make marijuana enforcement the lowest possible criminal enforcement priority for the Seattle Police Department. You know, in many ways, it already is. This is not something that the cops spend a lot of time worrying about in Seattle. This will probably wind up being tied up in courts. It will probably wind up that the federal government, which takes a very dim view of any kind of drug legislation that's mandated at a local level, witness the state medical marijuana initiative that passed to resounding nothing happening a few years ago. All that being said, vote yes, because what would a vote no mean? And because, frankly, it should be the lowest possible enforcement priority, it should be decriminalized entirely. So,
I agree with that.
That's 75. And then 77, we have the latte tax, which I feel really mixed about this. Actually, I don't feel mixed about it. I feel badly about it because early childhood education, the idea being taxing 10 cents a pop on your lattes in order to fund that, and it has very specific places that the early childhood education should be going to, the way the law has been written there. You know, it's not like ordinary initiatives or legislation where they fund it for a particular purpose and then it's up to the bureaucrats to decide, you know, how to do that. This is much more specifically allocated money. You know, I very much support early childhood education and I loathe coffee. I think it is nature's most execrable drink. And that being said, I have a really hard time finding a connection between the two. Why not tax disposable diapers? At least there's a connection and it's environmentally disposable.
I think we ought to tax sport utility vehicles and minivans.
I think that would be an outstanding idea.
Can afford to buy those. They can afford to chip in a little for early childhood education, and not only that, they could probably
afford more than 10 cents a pop too. You know, and particularly since it's the people with big families tend to buy minivans. I think that's only fair. So yeah, I would vote no on this. I think it's the sort of a thing that lends itself to mock people making, you know, mocking the initiative process, which I think is a shame.
Plus, it also puts a little bit of a strain on the few independent coffee houses that we have left in Seattle, and I frequent one, and I know that they're dreading having an extra tax imposed on them after they've had to seen an upping in their fees that they have to pay to King County for their a restaurant permit fee that they have to pay.
Whereas Starbucks and Tully's could not.
Restaurant license fee, just got upped severely in the past year. I think adding this tax on top of it would drive quite a few of those out of business.
Yeah, and Starbucks and Tully's would just as soon see this pass because, you know, if that can help drive some of their local competition out of business, well, then they can repeal it, get the tax lobbied in a couple of years after those places are gone. So mm-hmm. I would vote no.
All right, well, that's then pretty much the list. You know, since we're talking about candidates, I just had to mention that Jim Compton making the news again this week.
Oh, yeah.
apparently now he's paid back the $950 he thinks it was worth for the tickets on Paul Allen's private jet.
He hasn't really talked yet about all of the other direct correlations between visits he's been getting from Vulcan lobbyists and how he votes, or any of the various donations that he's been getting into his campaign from people associated with Vulcan.
And he's refused to recuse himself from any votes that
Compton is on the South Lake Union project. Compton is not only one of the most venally corrupt people on the city council. I would put Heidi Wills in that category also, and she's also up for re-election this time. But he's also by far the most arrogant, and maybe that comes from being on TV for all of those years. But he really has, and this is true both in person and in public. He has this sort of smug, patronizing, "I've been around longer than you are. I know better than you are. I'll just pat you on your head and you'll go away" kind of attitude that, I think he's really setting himself up for a fall, because I really think, you know, he's almost like the Rick Neuheisel of politics. He thinks he's smart enough to get away with this and he doesn't have to tell anybody about it. And unfortunately, this isn't football. This is, I mean, sports fans might disagree with this, but this is more important stuff that affects the lives of a lot more people. And I vote for his opponents in the primary. That's all I can say. And the general.
Very good. Let's move along. Our new regular spot, This Week in Iraq.
We're still waiting for the theme music.
We're working on that.
We should play the Leave It to Beaver theme music.
Or if people have suggestions
about what would be a good theme song,
go ahead and give us a call.
Email us.
520-5838 and let us know what you think the theme music
should
be.
Some things happened in Iraq this week, no surprise. The first one I want to talk about is that the Iraqi Governing Council, which was appointed by the U.S.'s viceroy in Iraq, Paul Bremer, has now appointed new cabinet ministers for Iraq. Now, the cabinet ministers are supposed to get things functioning. And I just want to point out a few things about these new cabinet ministers. Most of them are returning exiles, so they have no experience, very little political experience, and no experience with professional experience that relates to their new posts or any knowledge of how things have operated in the past in Iraq.
Well, then how, pray tell, did they get these posts?
Because most of the members of the Governing Council are returning exiles as well. Now, they're the same number of ministers.
They're buddies, in other words.
Yeah, they're the same number of ministers as there are members of the Governing Council. So each member of the Governing Council got to pick a minister. Gosh.
this sounds less like a democracy and more like a third world kleptocracy all the time.
It sounds like a kindergarten class, actually. It has the same ethnic and sectarian mix as the council. However, there's only one woman among the new cabinet ministers, whereas there were three on the Governing Council, so they're moving in the opposite direction as far as that's concerned. There is no Minister of Defense because, of course, the U.S. occupation forces are supposed to be doing all that. Ha ha. There is no budget for any of the new ministers to work with, so, of course, they can't actually get anything done. They can't even set up offices since most of the Iraqi ministry buildings were looted and torched during the recent war.
And they can't get into the U.S. compounds where all the decisions are really being made because they can't get past the checkpoints.
Right. Now, each ministry, of course, will still be supervised by a U.S. advisor.
Who will tell them what to do,
yes. And Paul Bremer retains ultimate control.
That's the viceroy.
Yeah, our viceroy retains ultimate control. Now, of the four most powerful positions, three of them went to exiles. The foreign ministry went to a representative of the main Kurdish political party, the KDP. The interior ministry, which is supposed to control the Iraqi police and the new paramilitary forces, went to a member of the Iraqi National Accord, which is another of the main exile groups. And the oil ministry went to a man returning from exile who has a lot of experience working in the U.S., but he has no familiarity at all with the Iraqi oil system, its infrastructure, or even how any political experience or how to run a major ministry.
Who did he work for in the U.S.? Texaco? Shell?
I don't know who he worked for. I know he has a degree from the University of New Mexico. He's the son of a Shiite cleric who sits on the Governing Council, who, by the way, had said that he was suspending his membership to the Governing Council after the bombing of the Imam Ali Mosque because of security reasons. So that's the new head of the oil ministry. That's basically what you have now for the new cabinet ministers. Their main task is supposed to be getting the country under control, getting the electricity going, the water, clean water going. But they have no budget. They have no support. They have no offices. They even went and sat down with Paul Bremer this past week, and along with members of the governing council, and complained about how the U.S. guards who are supposed and the Iraqi guards who are supposed to be keeping them from being attacked are falling asleep on the job and not doing their jobs properly. So this is a major problem.
And this is after the most powerful country in the world has spent 5 months in Iraq, and it hasn't gotten a single thing running yet.
That's
except,
right.
Of course, for its own compounds.
That's right. So really, these people are being set up to fail. Now, the other thing that I want, there are two other things I want to talk about that happened this week regarding Iraq. The second one is that Tony Blair over in Britain, Prime Minister Tony Blair's whole defense of the British dossier on which George Bush and the U.S. government based our reasons for going to war with Iraq, that British dossier on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, Blair's whole defense of it totally collapsed this week.
Yeah, that collapsing was the sound you just heard.
Yeah, when two high-level British intelligence experts testified that Blair and his aides had substantially altered the evidence in the intelligence report after they had delivered it to Blair. Now, Brian Jones headed the intelligence department responsible for investigating Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. So this is the top guy in the intelligence agency regarding Iraq, said on the stand that the dossier's language was too strong and that Blair's assertion that Iraq could deploy weapons of mass destruction in 45 minutes was absurd. It came from a single uncorroborated secondhand source which didn't appear to know very much about it at all and didn't have any convincing details. Now, Jones also questioned the use of the term weapons of mass destruction in relation to Iraq. He said it was completely inaccurate when you applied it to Iraq, that most of the evidence he had given to Blair and his aides regarding Iraq's weapons were mostly conventional weapons and had to do with trace amounts of chemical, biological weapons and a few little pieces of a mostly dismantled nuclear program. Finally, Jones said that the final draft of the dossier had not even been approved by the Joint Intelligence Committee, which is how these things are usually done, and that Tony Blair had claimed that the Joint Intelligence Committee had actually approved the final draft, and so Jones was saying that Blair had actually lied about that, and that Blair and his aides had altered nearly every aspect of the report before it was published.
And so this raises two questions. Number one, why is this not the stuff of leading the evening newscasts in this
here
country?
In the U.S.
And the second question is, why is the supposed birthplace of the world's democracy not have any kind of similar accountability, not have daily demands for congressional investigations and publicly televised hearings? Remember when Iran-Contra and Watergate happened, how everybody mm-hmm. watched those on TV? Why is this information not out in the public? Why are the Democrats not spending every hour of every day demanding all of this? Because
right.
if this was going on in Britain, you know perfectly well that it was going on double within the Bush administration, which was providing the political impetus for what they were doing in Britain.
Now,
but part of the reason they're even covering this in Britain is because of the investigation into the death of David Kelly.
Yes.
Opposed to, and this information is kind of coming out because of that. That kind of surprises me there, where they're not even like doing it based on the fact that there was bogus information that led to war. You know what I mean?
Yes,
you're right about that. And I think that's probably the reason why it's not happening here, is because nothing like that has really happened here in the U.S. There hasn't been any one person coming forward who has said this is such a this was such a problem, this is how it happened. You know, there have been little leaks here and there, but there hasn't been any major scandal like the death of David Kelly.
And you've had people like Daniel Ellsberg, who of course has that history in Vietnam, going around saying, he's been making a point of saying, if people are in the Bush administration are listening, you know, it is your patriotic duty, you need to be coming forward. He's been really specifically encouraging
bring
that
the
kind
documents
of an act.
Out and show
yeah,
us how
exactly.
this actually happened.
Yeah. And if anybody's listening to this program, go ahead, do it.
Do it today.
Don't even think about it. Just go down to Kinko's and start photocopying.
That's right.
And then just go directly to the FedEx office. Don't even go home to talk to your wife about it.
Uh-huh.
or husband, as the case may be.
All right. So the third thing I want to talk about in regards to Iraq this week, and it really is something that is not just related to Iraq, but also to North Korea, is that Donald Rumsfeld is finally losing ground a little bit to Colin Powell. That's a major shift that occurred just in the last week to a week and a half. is that after the bombings of, after the car bombings in Iraq, and after Paul Bremer visited Bush last week and asked for tens of billions of dollars for reconstruction, after riots in Basra over lack of fuel, water, and electricity, because Iraqi's oil fields are still not exporting enough oil to pay for the reconstruction or even a portion of the reconstruction or even the functioning of the new Iraqi government such as it is, Donald Rumsfeld is finally losing George Bush's ear on some of these foreign policy issues. And Colin Powell this week was finally allowed to go to the UN Security Council and ask for a new resolution to support the U.S. occupation. Now, that doesn't mean that the U.N. Security Council is going to agree. In fact, the U.S. draft resolution has changed very little. It still has not made any mention of ceding any kind of political or military control over to the U.N. Any U.N. force that would go in under this resolution would have to be under U.S. command, and I don't think that's going to work. And
yeah,
I don't think
all,
that's
the
be
European
allowed.
Countries have basically taken one look at it and laughed. I mean, it's really been a non-starter in the
mm-hmm.
U.N.
Yeah, but this week, Colin Powell has for the first time actually been allowed to place the draft of that resolution before the U.N. Security Council. In the past, he's only simply been able to ask. He hasn't been allowed to actually do that. He also this week has been allowed to negotiate with North Korea for the first time. Rumsfeld's position has always been that we do not negotiate with North Korea. We simply tell them they have to dismantle their nuclear weapons program, which has led us to where? Led us to a crisis where North Korea has all but announced that they're going to test nuclear weapons and go straight on ahead with their nuclear program. This week, for the first time, Colin Powell received the okay that we can actually bargain with them and offer them something in return for them dismantling their nuclear weapons program. And that's because Donald Rumsfeld is losing some of his influence over George Bush.
The fall of Rasputin.
We can only hope.
Okay, we just have a couple minutes left. And, Jav, there was a...
Yeah,
since
we don't have a whole lot of time, I'll refer people to workingforchange.com. I have a column up there talking about this, but there's a very important federal court decision on Thursday in the Philadelphia Federal District Court that basically it was an injunction that was issued to the FCC that put the entire media deregulation, the package of regulations that Michael Powell pushed through that we talked about quite a bit on this program several months ago. There's a hearing here in Seattle. It's very controversial. Passed in June. Was supposed to go into effect at the end of this week. All of it, not just the little piece, not 35% to 45% of media ownership. The whole thing was injuncted against in Philadelphia this week in a surprise three-panel judge decision. Those types of injunctions, this was considered very much a long shot because those types of injunctions are usually only issued when the court thinks that the plaintiffs, which are in this case was Prometheus Radio Project, a low-power FM group, and some public interest attorneys and other folks like Journalist Association, if they think the plaintiffs have a strong chance of winning on the merits of the case, which in this case, basically they sued to prevent the FCC from deregulating what little is left of the controls of media ownership. So that is a tremendous victory. We haven't seen the actual court ruling yet, of course. That won't come for a while. But, go to workingforchange.com for the details. And very, very good news on the media democracy front this week. And that is very much a political decision also. That decision probably would not have happened had there not been all of the activism and the public outrage and all the comments to the FCC and to Congress about this.
Right. So your work on this issue has paid off. All you folks who...
Everybody who's listening.
Wrote and called and complained.
Very much so.
All right. So on that happy note...
Yeah, we don't get really good news on this program very often.
No, we don't. We're filtered out as much as possible. Talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell us, where do we find Eat the State?
Well, all of those election picks are in the current issue, which is also on the web. Hooray. And it's at a free paper that's available where free papers are available all over town, bookstores and coffee houses and places like that. It's also on the web at www.eatthestate.org. You can also subscribe, and that's at P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145, $24 a year. We'll do it for you. Or if you want more information on any of that or want to volunteer, as most of us do, for that paper, you can give us a call. The voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.